Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode is episode number 93, Robert Swenskowski. We're going to talk about crime. We're going to talk about punishment. We're going to talk about why people commit crime and a host of other criminal-related subject matter type thingies when we come back. All right, so we're back to today's episode of The Brett Johnson Show. It's number 93. This is the 93rd. Actually, it's more than 93 because we've done some bonus episodes as well. Hey, look, as you may or may not know, I am trying to build up my subscriber base, listener base, viewer base. So if you don't mind, take a moment and hit that subscribe button. Hell, hit that like button. You might even want to leave a review if you want to, but look, only leave a review if it's a positive review. If it's not a positive review, well, I tell you what, leave it anyway. Some negativity helps every now and then. So leave a review if you don't mind, whether you like the show or not. Hit the subscribe button. What you don't like about the show, tell me in the comments section. Tell me in the review. I typically don't read the reviews, so leave it in the comments. But shoot me an email if you want to, whatever you want to do. Find me on LinkedIn. Find me on Twitter. Hit the subscribe. Please help me build up this user base. Look, today's episode, I'm bringing on Robert Swenskowski. And the reason I'm doing that, when I was given the opportunity to turn my life around, one of the first presentations I gave, actually the first presentation I gave, was for an academic conference in Las Vegas. A gentleman had invited me in. It was a freebie. So at that point in time, and I still do a lot of freebies today, especially for universities, law enforcement, things like that. But back then I was doing a lot of freebies, just trying to get my name out there. So I went in and gave a presentation at this academic conference, and I try to go to this same conference every single year these days. I've missed it the past couple of years because of COVID, because of my father being ill, things like that. But the conference, when I went to it, its main focus was you had PhD students that were doing the reviews. They were basically there, you know, all the PhD kids were there. I say kids, all the PhD students were there getting their PhDs. And they were all giving presentations talking about their thesis. And one of the things I noticed, one of the gentlemen that was given his presentation, he was giving a talk about fraud in Hong Kong. And you were allowed to ask questions after the presentation. And my dumbass, I didn't mean to get the guy in trouble or make him look bad or anything, but I just raised my hand and I was like, so what would you say are the largest or the most successful types of fraud that's happening in Hong Kong right now? And while he was supposed to be the authority on this, he was not able to talk about it. He couldn't give me one example of anything. The reason that's important is there is a huge disconnect between academics and what really happens on the street. That's not just crime. It's most every subject matter that's out there. There's a difference between what's taught in the books and what actually happens in real life. That's really prevalent in cybercrime, in cybersecurity. You've got your book training, and it says this, 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 and this, and you're supposed to do this, 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 and this, and everything works out all right. And what you find out is when you get out of school, all that book training, that shit goes out the window pretty quickly. Not saying that it doesn't have a benefit. It absolutely does, because it puts you on the same page as everyone else. But what I'm talking about, this disconnect, is I see a lot of academics on LinkedIn, especially on LinkedIn. I see a lot of academics that will come out and they'll be talking about Telegram or the dark web or criminal enterprises online, things like that. And a lot of the time, they really have no idea about what they're talking about because they've had no experience at all except for the academic world. And that's a problem because if you're getting all of your information from a book, you are lacking greatly. And that is why I like Robert Swenskowski. This is not the first time I've talked to Robert. I had him on the Anglerfish podcast. I love the guy. I absolutely do. I think he's amazing. I think he's got his finger on the pulse of things. I think he understands, you know, the real world aspects of crime, as well as the academic aspects. And you mix both those together and you've got a very powerful, very knowledgeable, insightful person like Robert. And I'm going to bring up right now his LinkedIn profile so you can just see some of the experience that this gentleman has, because I think it's important. If you're going to talk about crime, if you're going to say that you're an authority on cybercrime or cybersecurity, especially if you're going to say that, hey, I know what the criminals are doing, then by God, you ought to know what the criminals are doing. And Robert absolutely does that. So Robert Swenskowski, professor of practice, Utica University, assistant sheriff, Oneida County, criminal justice consultant, possesses over 30 years of public safety experience. And it goes on. I mean, he's master of science, degree in criminal justice. But you go down here to some of the his CV, as you would say. So deputy sheriff, Oneida County, August 92 through September 06, Village of New York Mills Police, chief of police from 2009, 2010. He's a police officer 2006, 2009. Oneida County Sheriff's again, 12 years, 10 months total. So you see, this man has an in-depth experience in law enforcement. And then you see, he makes a bit of a career change. He decides he's going to be a professor of practice at Utica University. This is Robert Swenskowski. This disconnect that I talk about, I'm big about doing academic conferences and talking to universities, trying to bridge that disconnect. Robert doesn't have that disconnect in place. He has a in-depth understanding of the criminal mindset, of criminal actions, of the way criminals act, behave, what have you. And now he's bringing that to a classroom type of environment. And that is an extremely powerful thing. So without further ado, Robert will talk some of his experience during this interview as well. But you guys, I'm just going to hand it over to the interview. Enjoy. And again, if you like the show, if you don't like the show, hit the subscribe button if you don't mind. Thank you. But look, man, I what about you? How are things going on your end?
Things are good. Things are good.
Family's good and everything?
It's so weird to say, like, COVID treated me well when we talked about this. You know, I went back to school because for teaching, they were, you know, nothing was contact. We were doing this so much. And I was like, I'm sitting around the house, I got to do something. So I went back to school. Now I'm at the point where, you know, I'm having my manuscript reviewed to defend my proposal. So I'm hoping I'm within the last year here. It would be cool. You know,
dude, that is beautiful.
Yeah, it'd be
great.
That
is absolutely beautiful.
I'm excited.
So I don't have a manuscript, but there is a guy working on one for me. So he is, it's Matt Baglia. The guy, he wrote the Argo book.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
He wrote that. He wrote the Pope's Exorcist. Wrote that thing too. So the guy we met, and he's working on the proposal. He's finishing the proposal up right now. They're hoping that it gets sold before the end of the year. They're going to market it at the same time with for TV show or film and stuff like that. And I got to tell you, Robert, my sincere hope. I was talking to Tom O'Malley yesterday. He's a former federal prosecutor out of Charlotte, and, you know, really good guy. I mean, he really just wants to help people. And so he retired from being a prosecutor, and he's been trying to do cyber. And honestly, the dude has not made one penny in all these years trying to do cyber, not a penny. And, you know, he was complaining about it, has a lot of apathy. And he was saying, he's like, you know, it's just that LinkedIn, the only thing it is building people's brands. And I was like, yes, Tom, that's the only thing that it is. And, you know, that's me, man, is I'm hoping that with the book and everything that I'm able to give up the tech stuff when I turn 60, that's 7 years from now, because sure. I've got, you know, I see these companies that they try to sell products with fear and uncertainty and doubt. And, sure. You know, you've got the other companies that they don't want to put the budget into, you know, the correct tools they need to mitigate attacks. And I'm just like, man, I am just finished with this stuff. I'm so apathetic these days.
Frustrating. It's got to be frustrating.
It is. But I am damn happy that COVID did not treat me well. I'm glad it treated you well. So the reason I wanted you to come on, initially the reason was to talk about this Lucy Letby.
Yep.
This nurse over in the UK that she got convicted of killing, what was it, 7 babies?
7, and I think there was 6 attempted murder charges.
Injecting air into their stomachs.
Yep. Insulin, air in the IVs, overfeeding.
Yeah. My wife, she's a nurse, and she literally just began a new job working with babies.
Okay.
And she absolutely loves it. And I look at the job my wife is doing, and at the same time I'm thinking about this Lucy Letby, and it kind of feeds into this whole idea. And I wanted you to comment on Lucy, but I also want to talk about why some people break the law and why others don't. And I that's a big ass question.
So you're going into the subject of criminology. And that's what criminology is, that study of behavior and crime and why. And prior to, there's 3 main schools, and under these schools, now there's all these different theories. But prior to those schools being developed, it was, people are witches. let's sink you into the water. If you float up, you're innocent. It's like, okay. just crazy stuff. People are possessed, things like that. 3 schools of thought: classical, neoclassical, positivism,
okay,
and Chicago or sociological. So I'll go backwards. Sociological basically looks at like the environment, like what you're in, economic situations, who you hang around with, those things that influence people to commit crime. Right. Positivism went to like people are born criminals, how it started out, like you're going to be a criminal because your forehead is over 5 inches long or your ears are this. It was
so that phrenology bullshit.
But it developed more into things like, psychological issues, mental health issues, chemical imbalances, things like that, which are legitimate, that influence crime. And then the classical, neoclassical, which is free will.
Okay.
We decide ultimately. Today, in this country at least, laws are still based on that oldest school of free will. We've got the pain and pleasure. Hey, I can sell cocaine. I might do 8 to 12 years in prison.
Right.
Sell cocaine, get a whole bunch of money, don't go to prison. It's down here, but I might go to prison. So it's risk reward, what we want to do. I want to eat candy bars every day. I'm going to get fat. okay.
I like candy bars too.
Yeah.
It's like, I've not tried cocaine. I might like that.
So we do this. Everyone has that pain and pleasure, but it goes back to free will. If we ever found, take the positivism school, that there is a crime gene, we would have to change all the laws because this would show it literally has no control over doing that. And that intrinsically it's in their body. So basically what it comes down to is most researchers and people that, try to explain theories are really not working in absolutes going, look, it's just the classical theory or just social influences. Most of them are creating theories that are combining. Yes, at the end of the day, these decisions are free will decisions. However, because of the learning theory or strain theory or labeling theory, all these different issues or situations people are put in and influences, they have a greater propensity of why. So that's kind of explaining how their behavior cultivates. And again, I'm not a criminologist. This is very rudimentary as far as an understanding goes, but it's a whole field of study. So, and a lot of this is referred to as, it occurs subconsciously.
Okay.
You're put in this situation, strain theory, literally a strain to acquire what the average person has, the wants and needs of everyone. You can't do it through socially acceptable norms, meaning I'm going to get a job and being able to buy a car. So I'm going to steal one. So you do it through these socially unacceptable means, but you need that because the strain of having what everyone else wants is what's putting you in this situation. Ultimately, you still have to decide to go
right.
That's why it kind of all falls back to that classical school of thought. So when we talk about behavior, most theories are saying the decision is made, person is doing that of free will, but there are influences over them, depending on the situation, circumstances they're in, whether it's psychological, whether it's physical, whether it's environmental, those things have an influence on the behavior of committing crime.
I got you. So and you were a law enforcement officer,
mm-hmm.
a damn good one. So you know, you had boots on the ground. So it's not just, you know, it's not just the book learning, which I got to be honest with you, just book learning, I'm not a big fan of that.
I wasn't either. I wasn't either for a long time.
So with that hands-on experience that you've got, mixed with, you know, the theories that you're able to read through and process using that hands-on experience, what's your thought process? I'm going to be doing a show about systemic racism and how it affects cyber criminals. All right. The different types of crime these groups go into. And, you know, I see a lot of these neighborhoods, you know, ethnic neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, where a lot of the individuals there, not a lot, but there's a percentage of the individuals there that go into the crime that area is known for, whether it be prostitution or, you know, mafia related crime or drug trafficking or what have you. And then you've got some people that don't. And I'm guessing that's a mixture of all these different theories that you're talking about. It's not just the upbringing or the environment, but is there a biological element of that too, or not?
I probably couldn't speak to I would say the biological would fall. I mean, in my experience or understanding, like, you know, people with psychological issues, whether they're, you know, behavioral issues, whether they're emotional issues, that might draw them to crime. I really support, or I guess I understand, or it sits well with me, like the learning theories where this is learned behavior. We talk about criminalization or prisonization, where, right, you know, someone goes to prison for a DWI and then they're hanging out with other people, and next, like the movie Shot Caller, is dramatic as it is. I'm like, that's like, dude, you want to explain prisonization? Just go watch that movie. You know, this guy gets to prison for DWI and comes out, he's a hardened killer.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, exaggerated, dramatized, but that's really, you know, it's similar to criminalization, where you learn things from other criminals. There were people that learned from you and your organization more than likely. And that's how they got better at doing what they got. Right. It's like being a serial killer. You know, there are serial killers that they know have communicated with each other on doing things. And then there's others, it's trial and error. We had a guy locally who certainly would have fit the bill for a serial killer. He cut a prostitute in half. He kept the bottom half, in a barn in his backyard to like do things with. But he had literature on stabbing someone in the back of the neck, and there was a spot that they can't make any sound. And he finds this prostitute on a roadway, when it stabs her in the back of the neck, she went screaming down the road.
Just to test,
you know, so some of it's trial and error for these people to learn what they're doing. But I guess this sits well with me, because we learn about, you know, whether it's, you know, raising a family, you know, supporting a household, working at our job. I mean, a lot of that stuff is learned.
Right.
That's a theory that it sits well with me, and very understandable, and to me, very reasonable, that a lot of this behavior is learned. Why people decide to commit crimes is probably more situational, you know, whether it's their environment or the situation, people they're with, or how they want to get things, and they make that decision. I'm sure there's influences that brought them there.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of the day, to be good at what they do, I think one of law enforcement's biggest failings is where you'd hear police officers be like, hey, dirtbags, these idiots. And so like, they're not, they're extremely intelligent people that do well at what they do. There's serial killers that are never caught. There's drug dealers, arms dealers, you know, child predators, traffickers, they're never going to be caught. They're good at what they do.
And you know, that's you made a few points there. You know, the learned behavior. I mean, you know my history. I began around 10 years old, and my mom was the model. And people from that. So I absolutely agree with the learned behavior and even that trial and error. I mean, when I started my life of cybercrime and fraud, it was a lot of trial and error. I had visits from law enforcement that just didn't do anything.
Right.
But you know, so, and that was it. So I would screw up. Law enforcement would come knocking. I was like, okay, I screwed up. Let's not do that again.
Right.
and go on from there.
That went well.
and you know, the other thing, and I did a podcast yesterday, this mental health podcast, really great conversation. And we talked about a lot of this, man, but, the other thing is I was really big about justifying it. You know, when I was a kid, I was doing it for me and my sister. Then as I got older, it was for family. And then as my wife left me, it was, well, I'm doing it for my stripper girlfriend. And, you know, I believe
there is a whole, I want to say it's four or five again. This is criminology.
Okay.
You hit on those justifications is important because it's like dealing with, it's like a lot of cops becoming cynical. You see a lot, you see suicides and car accidents, and you have to deal with it. You can't compartmentalize it. People who with criminal behavior do the same thing. And that's exactly what a lot of it is. You're like, I have to do this.
Yeah.
You know, I deserve to do this because this is the way I'm going to get what everyone else can. The whole system's against me. Or this rebellious attitude, like I'm not living by societal norms. You know, and there's this whole justification that goes for people because they got to cope with it too. I mean, we are all human beings. I do believe there's very few people. There's some sociopaths or psychopaths that in here, they don't feel anything. If you look at Richard Kuklinski, like his interview with the Iceman, like I don't have any feeling for anybody. Like outside my kids, I don't care. Things don't bother me. Most people aren't like that. So you do got to get past victimizing people, you know, and that's a process as well.
Yeah, I watched I remember those Kuklinski interviews when they first aired on HBO. This would have been early 90s, what got me so bad, he was talking about the people he had killed.
Yeah.
And he told this story about the one guy who was praying to God. And Richard looked at him and said, I gave him, you know, so many minutes to see if God would show up.
Yeah.
And God didn't show up.
Yeah. And I think that was I don't know if it was the same one where he said, you know, he basically tormented a guy because he got called away on a holiday from his family.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, if it was any other day, I would have done this, but because that situation.
But later on, you know, the interviewer asked Richard, do you regret anything? And Richard said he regretted that.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I mean, that was a cold man right there. I mean, talk about sending shivers.
If you talk about theories or theorize that he was a serial killer that got into the best line of work because he talked about being anxious when I forget if it was the Bonanno crime family or whichever Italian organized crime family it was, but they were like, hey, there's a lot of heat on. And he's like, where's the work? Where's the work? He was like, more than likely he had this compulsion. He had no problem with killing people. Right. And he just found the best line of work for him.
So let me ask you, and that's, I love how, you know, we don't prep anything. So it goes wherever it goes. I've been, you know, looking at some of these, and I'm not well read on a lot of this. I read some, but it seems like a lot of these serial killers that, or rapists or what have you, like the architect guy it seems like they're really good family guys. And on the side, yeah. So is that a common thing where you see that they compartmentalize that in one aspect of their lives that they come off as very healthy? And in the other aspect, they're just absolute, you know, creatures, animals.
Yeah. I would just scale it right back to someone that has any compulsory behavior. And by compulsory, I don't mean like this is just a thing, like they literally have to do this. I had a friend who probably had some significant OCD. I never got it. We were very young. He was another cop. We were going to go out and do stuff.
Right.
And I go to his house, and it would take an hour and a half for him to leave because he's like, oh, I just got to organize this. And, you know, one, he's putting firewood and stacking in a certain way. It's like time to go. What are we doing? You know, and didn't realize like they have to do this. Think about someone who's like binge eating and, you know, they're living a great life. And then, you know, when they're going home, they're stopping in a parking lot and eating a dozen donuts, you know, every other day because they have to do it. Those are that same type of behavior for serial killers. From what my understanding is that compulsion or sexual predators, it's a compulsion that builds up and builds up and builds up. I want to do this. I need to do this. And they do it. And we have some that, you know, you see that frequency keep increasing and increasing and increasing.
Right.
There's less time between it. And then the others that can go, you know, this MO of killings, abductions and killings happened for a year. And then there was a 5-year span and that happened to you. And we know it's the same person, but and it's gone on for 30 or 40 years that they do it. So I think it's the compulsion is the issue, is like in the frequency and the severity of how these people are how much they have to do this to satisfy that need.
So you take someone like this Lucy Letby, this nurse who targets babies. I'm having a lot of trouble figuring out or understanding how you get to where that, I mean, I can understand, look, I can understand some son of, I can't understand it, but I can almost understand some son of a bitch that decides he's going to target prostitutes because he's got some sort of sexual compulsion. Okay. I can understand that. Or he wants to dominate. He doesn't have control, whatever the hell that is. All right. I'm having a lot of trouble understanding how someone targets a newborn child as their victims, how that serial killer gets to that. I mean, where is that compulsion like that? I mean, what leads to that being your victim of choice?
From what I understand too, is part is selecting the victim. So selecting a victim, there's like a victimization triangle.
Okay.
There's,
could you talk about that? Because hell, I didn't even know that there was one of those.
There's an offender. There's a potential victim. They don't need to know each other. The victim, sometimes the details aren't specific about the victim. It's more about the opportunity. And then there's this thing called capable guardian. This is it. Could be a security camera. Could be a person walking down the street that deters this potential offender. But absence of capable guardian, now you bring these elements into this triangle. And there you have victimization, crime occurring. A lot of times with serial killers, from what I've been researching, reading prior to us talking, is it's not they want to kill a child, or what they're looking at is the victim, the least amount of resistance. How are they going to stay in control? So now, especially if we talk about, like we talk about prostitutes, one thing is, you know, a lot of serial killers that have talked to law enforcement or psychologists after the fact is saying, listen, one thing I knew was that if I killed a prostitute, less people were going to come looking.
Right. Right.
And so it wasn't really about me saying I want to kill prostitutes. Like, I wanted to kill women, and this was a more vulnerable population.
Because nobody cares about them. It's easy to get them alone.
There you go.
They're already breaking the law. So the chances, if you're not able to kill them, of them reporting to law enforcement, probably not. And if you do, law enforcement may not listen to them because you have some law enforcement that does that kind of stuff.
We've had it happen. There's still one to this day. And I left with this case still being unsolved. And it occurred before I even became under sheriff's department. But I talked to the lady's mother, and her daughter was a prostitute and a drug user.
Okay.
And you know what? Do I think the same level of effort and concern, both like from investigatory agencies and the public, were that if it was 16-year-old girl was abducted from school? Was no, I don't. Right. I don't think the same level of attention was given. When you talk about serial killers in hospital or care settings, now that's a whole different thing as well. They are also looking for that vulnerable population. So it's children or elderly, or look at higher rates of mortality. So if you go into a unit like a cancer unit or a neonatal unit that's taking care of preemies, or elderly homes, where do more people die in those? There. Okay. Now there's a cover. And Lucy Letby, that was one of the big things is that, well, we do have mortality rates with babies. So that was, you know, much more maybe normal than going into like ambulatory surgery where people are having their tonsils out, or some one day surgery where you don't have a lot of high mortality rates that might have caused more concern. Right. So it's, from what I understand, the combination of looking where it will be noticed less and where you could have more control over your victim. Because we've even seen with serial killers that are male, that combination sexual predators, killers, that women that have got away or fought back, and they just, like, they don't know what to do. I didn't plan for this, and these women get away. They weren't physically overpowering. They just, it didn't go, their plan didn't go right.
Right. Which makes sense. I mean, as and Lord knows I've not done that, but, you know, looking at financial crime, you plan for a certain scenario. And then when things don't work like that, you know, you're not planning on getting caught,
right?
Or someone calling you out at the bank, sure, which has happened to me.
Sure.
And you're right. You don't know what to do.
And oh, crap.
Yeah. You have no idea. Let me ask you this. And you know, I'm a TikTok fan. I shouldn't admit it because I'm in cybersecurity, but I'm a TikTok fan. And I watch these TikTok. You stop at one thing for just a second, and it starts feeding you countless videos on that. So needless to say, there is some questionable content on my TikTok because, you know, something pops up and I'm like, oh, what is it? And I try to change it, but it's too late.
Yeah.
But that being said, some of the videos that pop up on my TikTok are of, you know, riots, shoplifting, assaults,
sure,
things like that. And typically in these videos, you've got the attacker, you've got the victim, and then you've got bystanders. And those bystanders are not doing anything. And I hearken back, the reason I bring that up, you know, there was that, I think it was the 70s, the case in New York of that woman who was assaulted. She was raped, just went through an entire hellacious thing of, it starts like in a parking lot. She makes it to her apartment. The assault continues through the stairwell of the apartment, and all these individuals, it was like 20 some, I think it's like 20 some different witnesses saw this thing happening, saw the woman crying for help, and no one assisted her. And because of that, these days you hear the thing, if you're ever a victim of rape, to yell fire, not rape.
All right.
Come. My question is why, and maybe it's too big of a question, I don't know, but why don't people get involved when they see crime happen?
That is a big question. You know, when you say bystander, man, what an accurate term then, because that's what people become when those things happen. And they pull out their phone and video and you're a bystander. You're just complete. I can get being unwilling to help in a physical altercation. If you don't think you could do something, maybe that's just not for some people.
Right.
Not like you're going to video something over calling 911. Over yelling at someone again. I mean, it's sickening.
It doesn't make any sense.
For me, it's really disgusting. It's so sad. I think there's probably a very deep answer to that. And part of it's cultural with us, maybe even, I don't know, internationally how that occurs. But I mean, like looking at an active shooting incident, there was one in an airport and people still like pulling their luggage along.
Yeah.
They're not letting go of that or being on their phones. There's shots in the background.
Well, yeah. They're just strolling.
What's wrong with you? You know,
oh, it's another shooting.
There's something different with me then. But those are things I get frustrated with. And I certainly, if I'm going to be honest, lose a lot of faith in humanity when I see things like that and go, you know, I think culturally we're desensitized to so much. Because if you think about, go back prior to social media or the explosion of just media itself, even with, I can only use the word legitimate media, maybe or maybe not. That's but the exposure to it, the access to it, you know, I mean, I never, you know, think about growing up, you know, I never saw someone assaulted or killed or things like that. I mean, you can get on how many platforms and just
view that. Yeah. Yeah.
After seeing anything, because that's certainly an experience, you know, I went through after going to so many car accidents or unattended deaths, I'm not talking about anything even violent, but just seeing people that were, you know, dead and whether they've been there a month or 2 days, I mean, you got to get desensitized to it because it's part of, you know, that's how you survive is, you know, and it's sad and sick to some extent, but you know, you walk away from the scene and, you know, someone makes a joke about how, you know, blown up a body was or something like that. They're trying to just get over that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I get that. I mean, I get that morbid humor. I mean, you've seen something that is traumatic. It's going to affect you the rest of your life. It's common to say something, you know, to try to process through that by saying some bullshit.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of, you know, what they call the, and again, you go back to, you know, theories, you know, the bandwagon effect or, you know, the monkey see monkey do. I mean, right. You know, I just, someone's going to have to convince me otherwise. There's not a lot of independent thinkers out there that are willing to go against the crowd, you know, whether it's peer pressure, bandwagon, however you want to say it. They see someone do something and it's not normally what they do, but hey, here, let me just fit in and do the same thing.
Yeah, I'm 53 and I am not the guy anymore that does not step in. Now I say that because back when I was in college, I was married when I was 24. I was on the 7-year college program.
Yep.
Just, you know, and I remember me and my wife, we went to the Ringling Brothers Circus. Mm-hmm. And it was in Lexington, Kentucky. And she and I got out of the car. And when we got out of the car, almost at the same time, there were another two groups of people that were walking toward the circus, the arena, Rupp Arena at the same time. And so there was one group in front of us, just a gentleman and his girlfriend, me and my wife. And then back behind us, there were like three or four, and they were drunk. And I remember, man, that they left me and my wife alone. But the couple in front of us, they tormented the hell out of them. I mean, just berating them, trying to fight them. And I was the guy who was the bystander. I did not say a word. I just kind of ducked my head and told my wife, I was like, just keep walking. And I regret that. I remember that vividly, and I regret that to this day, man. And you know, these days I'm not the bystander at all. If somebody's, you know, if somebody's arguing, somebody's about to get I'm there.
Hey, know? Everything okay? You know, or really need to do that? Yeah, and I've had those same experiences. You know, as longer and even get into law enforcement, it is not easy to do.
Right.
We do a training at the college, you know, it's called the Green Dot training, and it's about, you know, intimate partner violence on campuses for kids or something. And, you know, the Green Dot representing that intervention to stop that red dot from happening.
Right.
And a lot of it, we talk about levels of intervention, you know, direct and indirect. Not a lot of people can do direct intervention, but the indirect, hey, you know, you see someone in a bad situation, hey, you know, Sam, come on over here. We're going to take a group picture and then get the person out of there.
Right.
You know, indirect or asking someone, you know, 911, camp security, whatever, could you intervene? And I guess that's my thing is, I get the direct thing is hard because you don't know. I mean, I know of two people who were killed because of direct intervention. One was in Florida. It was my dad's good friend. Lady was getting picked on in a bar. My dad's friend tells this guy, lay off. And Ernie was a big guy.
Yeah.
Like us. He was a big, big dude. And the guy waited outside the bar and shot him in the back of the head.
Jesus.
One of the sergeants I worked with, his son moved down to Florida. He's on a beach. Same thing. Guy slapping his kid, slapping his girlfriend around. He intervenes. The guy punches him, knocks him out. He falls into the tide in 2 inches of water and drowns and dies.
Jesus, dude.
So to say direct intervention has its risks, and we'd say within your capabilities, be careful. You know, I mean, I'll say it because I've been a cop for so long, and I carry a gun every day. So there's also a level of security there for me going, if things go bad, I guess I'm okay. And that might be a false sense of security, but that's not the average fail safe for people. So they have to depend on, you know, what level do I want it? But the indirect, that's what everyone says. Like, all you need to do is pick up the phone. You could dial 911, not say a word, and the police are going to show up where that GPS pings.
Right. Instead of filming that assault,
right,
you could dial 911. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I'll say it on the other side too. And I give the people at, you know, where George Floyd was killed, a lot of I cannot believe I guess to some extent I can, that not one of those bystanders really tried to physically intervene, because they were so reasonable in what they said. Dude, you got the guy arrested. Just get him off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at that point,
especially shame on everyone's other, oh, so hard on the other cops that did nothing. I go, absolutely not. Those guys got everything they deserved as well. Right. That was murder. Right.
And I don't understand. I mean, hell, I would hope that I would have tackled the damn cop that was standing on top of the guy's neck. Yeah, I may have been charged for something, but by God, he wouldn't be standing on the guy's neck anymore.
And that's what bothered me. I go, if you did that, we'd never know about George Floyd. We'd never know who the guy was. And you'd probably have gotten, like, you know, probation or 6 months in jail.
Something.
You saved the dude's life.
But I would have been liked in jail.
Sure. it's just so sad. Yeah, so the intervention party, I totally agree with it. I mean, you know, people literally become bystanders, and I think they're desensitized to, like, if you don't have any emotion or feeling for what you're looking at that's so horrific that you can't intervene, but you can film it, man, you better go to a professional and get some help.
Well, is there any school of thought on how to change that? Of how to get people to stop just being voyeurs and active, or at least passively active?
I think it goes back to learning. I think we need to relearn some things, you know. I mean, I don't like to, you know, I certainly wasn't a perfect parent, but I have three boys in their 20s. They're gainfully employed. They're living on their own.
Right.
And dealing with the normal stuff that we deal with. So I hate using the word normal, because sometimes we have to define it, you know. Like, say, you know, like, even when it comes to crime, well, you know, if you look normal, well, listen, I was arrested for committing a crime. You're arrested for criminal behavior, so maybe it is normal. You know, right. Criminal behavior might be normal. Class, civility, things like that. I don't know. I don't want to say it's a thing of the past, but
seems, you know, like it.
Respect. I mean,
oh, you know, respect. Don't get me started on that.
We've had this conversation about that word. I mean, respect is huge. People have killed each other over being disrespected. And respect is, I literally, first day of classes yesterday, I talk about that. And I have an acronym for respect.
Right.
And,
what's the acronym?
Oh, you're going to make me say.
I am. You know, you mentioned it.
Respect. E, encourage. I created it. And that's sad that you put me right on the spot. But basically going through. You know, T at the end is teach. And C in it is civility.
Okay. You know,
being civil to each other, encouraging. It's basically all positive terms and terminology within the educational environment. And I tell people my job is easy as an educator in higher education in a college setting. I do two things. I make sure that I facilitate your achievement, and I make sure the people that don't take that seriously don't impede you. Most of the time I get questioned on the second one. What do you mean? I'm like, if you're not here to learn, you're not going to screw someone else's experience up. That's how it's going to be.
Right. Right.
You know, you
mentioned respect. The show I've been doing, you know, it's been cybersecurity, and I've started doing interviews like with you. Yep. And what I'm doing is that I'm alternating every week. So 1 week I'll have a former felon. The next week I'm going to have a law enforcement, security professional, something like that, just to kind of give an overview of how everything's operating.
Right.
Talking to these former felons, and I talked to a guy named Ted Durbin, spent 32 years in Angola. I mean, the dude's out there. All right.
Wow.
Talked to a husband-wife team. The husband has served, I think, a total of 28 years. He's only been free. The longest he's been free is right now, for a year and a half. And they all talked about respect, how it differs from behind the fence to outside. And I started to think about that. I made a post on it on LinkedIn. And you know, the thing is that when you enter into prison, you immediately give respect to people, and it's up to them to keep it at that point in time.
Sure.
And on the outside, it doesn't work like that. And it was interesting to me that I was talking to these people, and they were really big about that. How when you know, for example, when you're behind the fence, if you tell someone you're going to do something, that, you know, you'll give them something, or you've got them for commissary next week or something like that, they rely on that.
Yeah.
And if you don't follow your word, there are consequences to that. And out here, it doesn't work like that.
No, I agree. And it's so funny you say that. That is the exact speech that I give the students. And I tell them, I said, all of you have my respect. I said, you can lose it. I go, it's not going to be over a bad grade or not doing an assignment. It's going to be over some egregious behavior.
Right. But
I give people my respect. And I think we talked about this, you know, encountering people on in the street. I have my attitude because when I was arrested, the state trooper that arrested me gave me all sorts of respect at 15 years old.
Right.
And I never forgot being treated like that. And
it makes a difference.
And I worked with a partner. He was a little OCD about germaphobe and stuff like that. Listen, we dealt with some homeless person and they stuck out their hand to shake my, I'm shaking her hand. That's just me. That's a sign of respect. Why do you do that, Target? Listen, it's never going to change with me. That's how I'm going to be.
Right.
Because I give that level of respect. And I totally agree with you today, you know, that people have to earn my respect. Oh, you know, what is this? Is it a game? Is
right.
it, I mean, who are you?
Yeah. Who are you exactly? Robert, I'm going to let you go in a minute. I do want to ask you a couple more things. Are there any, we were talking about the serial killers, the predators, things like that. I'm thinking about Letby. I'm thinking about the architect, Kuklinski. I'm thinking about people like this. Are there any real telltale signs that people should be aware of or look at? Because, I'm not really seeing anything like that.
I probably wouldn't be the person to answer that. What I did see that was consistent when Letby's coworkers talked about is that the one thing that was consistent in these deaths is that she was there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of criticisms on the NHS hospital systems for kind of blowing this off internally.
Right.
And this is like bad behavior with cops. And, you know, when it's public, all of a sudden something's done internally. People kind of drag their feet sometimes or ignore that behavior. So the hospitals did the same thing. They were worried about their reputation and stuff like that. I don't see overwhelming physical evidence until they actually found the notes where she was talking about, you know, I'm doing this cause I'm bad and I can't take care of the children, stuff like that. But signs, I mean, I think that's the thing is if that person can become that common denominator, so in a like a care setting, that might be more apparent because they're at a job working where, you know, they're out in the public.
Right.
How do you draw that person into it? So I think a lot of times, because they've had about a half a dozen prolific killers in that hospital system in the UK, in that NHS system.
I was wanting to do, and I'm going to do a show on Letby. I thought it would be easy to put that show together. And the truth of the matter is no one in a position of authority in the UK wants to talk about this publicly at all.
You know, it's funny because there's a person I met that just retired from Scotland Yard, and I'll probably give his information anyways to see if they would make it. And he's a college professor as well, and a very well-versed, law enforcement officer as well as an educator. I think, you know, culturally, and I don't want to misspeak about the UK, but, you know, just from reading a lot of the things, how this went over and how this, like her sentence, this whole life sentence, life without parole. That's
right.
I'm not scoffing at it, but it was like, that's a huge deal to get this. There is certainly it's a different culture. I think there's a lot of pride and a lot of focus on, you know, reputation and experience. And I think that was one of the failings in this investigation. And still, I'm very curious. I mean, the jury, it took them 22 days to deliberate on her case. I
want nutty.
Were you just being thorough or were there some questions here? Because I don't see a lot of physical evidence. And I'm not saying she didn't do it. I just said, wow, there's not a lot of physical evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that was Robert Swinzgowski. And I cannot thank him enough for coming on the show and talking to me. Hey, if you've not noticed, The publication date of this episode has changed. I'm no longer putting out shows on Tuesday. I'm now putting out shows on Monday, late Monday morning. I'm thinking probably 11 a.m. Eastern. That gives me time enough to get my ass out of bed if I've not edited the show beforehand to put the show together and get it uploaded by that, you know, 11 a.m. Eastern timestamp. I'm going to be doing two shows a week as well. So shows will now be out on Wednesdays and on Sundays around 11 a.m. Eastern. So one will be an interview type format show like we're doing with Robert. And if you've not noticed, what I'm doing is I'm alternating weekly interviews between security professionals, law enforcement, former felons, things like that. I'm going to probably expand that type of interview format as well and bring in a variety of different types of individuals that I think are interesting to talk to. While I'm doing the interview format, on Sundays, I will be releasing a solo episode where we'll talk about... So as you know, the Brett Johnson Show is basically a therapy-type show clothed in a cybersecurity, cybercrime, and identity theft veneer. That's what it is. So I work through a lot of issues here, and I also am on this journey to try to figure out how to be a better person. But at the same time, I'm adamant about trying to educate, entertain, and enlighten about cybersecurity, cybercrime, identity theft, scams, hustles, frauds, what have you. So I want to continue doing that on a solo show, and then just doing one show a week is not really allowing me to do that, because I'm tending to do the interview format for 2 weeks in a row and then my solo and having it like that. So I'm going to speed that up, and we're going to have an interview a week and a solo show a week and go like that. My name is Brett Johnson. This is the Brett Johnson Show. If you don't mind, take a moment, subscribe to the show. Yeah, you'll notice I'm hyping up that subscribe issue. You know, hit the like button, leave me a review if you don't mind. Send me some comments about what you like, what you don't like, guest suggestions, what have you. That being said, it's time to close things out. This is Brett Johnson Show. How do we do that? How do we close the show out? Well, we close it out the same way every single time. Stay safe out there. Stay secure. Stay vigilant. More importantly, this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.